Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, September 13th, 2012. The main science topic tonight, I'll be continuing the discussion of calendars. It's a very complicated topic. So last week was kind of an introduction. So you have to go back and listen to last week's show if you did not hear it. And by the way, I apologize. I think it was finally Tuesday when I got it posted on the archive page. I'm very sorry for that. I was out of what you might call out of radio range and was not able to post it right away. But if you did miss that show, if you listen on the archives, please go back, listen to that. It's a very important show. And it'll make this show, this is a series, you can listen to them out of order, that's not a problem. But this is just a very complex topic, the concept of calendars, calendarization. What do we use for calendars? And let me just make this comment because I got a number of listener comments during the week, both by email and otherwise. Calendars amount to time. What's time? Time is the repetition of cycles of something. The Mayans used the repetitious cycles of the orbit of Venus. They did that because Venus was a large comet in the ancient days, in their ancient history. They knew Quetzalcoatl was the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart eventually became the planet Venus. And so Venus became a clocking, something that they watched, something that they kept track of. So their main calendar, although they had sun and moon calendars also for counting, their main calendar was based on the cycles of Venus, and it took hundreds of years. The ancient Mayans, I'm not talking about the modern Maya, 800 to 1300 AD, I'm talking about the ancient Maya, 1500 BC, that developed the number system and the calendar system that was eventually handed down. But a calendar is simply a timepiece for counting. So these cycles of the celestial objects don't line up perfectly. So what do we have? We have the cycles of Venus the Mayans used. The Aztecs used a solar calendar based on the Venus, based on the Mayan calendar. But by the time the Aztecs came around, much later, they were concentrating on the solar calendar. They still talked about Quetzalcoatl, but it wasn't as prominent as in the Mayan, who very much kept the tradition of Quetzalcoatl and Venus as the central part of their mythology and calendar. So the Aztecs had a 360-day calendar, and by the way, a lot of the imitation wannabe calendar experts out there on the internet, a lot of quacks out there, they showed the Aztec calendar and call it the Mayan calendar. No, what they're showing is the Aztec calendar. The Mayan calendar is very different. The Aztec sun calendar is typically what is shown for the Mayan calendar, and that's incorrect, totally incorrect. So in modern times, the Julian calendar, which started in 45 or 43 BC, something like that, by Julius Caesar, the one we use today, the same calendar that's used today and updated and corrected, now we're in the 2000 version of the Julian calendar. But the modern calendar uses the sun and the stars for calendarization. The moon is a secondary issue. The moon has a 28-day cycle, approximate 28-day cycle. Our months have a 30 or 31 days except for February, which has 28 days, except in leap year, which has 29 days. So you see all of these exceptions. But our you can see that if our months have 30 or 31 days, then in a year, 365 days in one quarter day, one extra quarter day, the number of lunar cycles, which is 28 days long, that doesn't add up. That's constantly adjusting month after month after month. It's losing a couple days every month in the lunar calendar. So we do not use the moon, per se, in calendarization. We use the zodiac, which some people think, well, that's astrology. No, that's the counting of the Earth year in terms of 12 divisions in the celestial, the stellar celestial sphere, the sphere of stars. And the sun is just sitting there. We orbit around the sun. And so basically, when we come around full circle, so to speak, or full ellipse, if you want to put it that way, to where the Earth is in exactly the same position relative to the stars, when we come around the sun and we're in exactly the same position relative to the stars, we call that a year. That's 1 year. And that's 365.466 days. So at any rate, this is very complicated, and the length of our days changes. So there's a lot of complication in the calendars. But the modern calendar, we use the sun and the stars. And people have said, I made the comment last week, I said, the moon is not used for calendarization. And that's true. In the modern Julian calendar, the moon is not a factor. We have many ritual holidays that are based on lunar cycles. The Passover is calculated on the moon cycle. In the springtime, a lot of the fall, the old Celtic holidays, which were made into Christian holidays, which now have been made into basically Jewish buy-at-the-store holidays, a lot of those are based on lunar cycles, but they fit into our solar star calendar, which is the Julian calendar. Okay, so this is very complicated, so I'm going to talk more about this, and I just want to comment, too. One woman asked the question. She has the recalendar device in her hands. She has gotten it, and she's looking at it, and she says, gee, I hope I can figure out how to do recalendarization after a pole shift. Is this complicated? Well, if you use the recalendar portable sun star clock, the one that's offered on my webpage, if you use that on a daily basis and you see the sun walking through its local daily progression along the calendar, the calendar gives both it's a sun, basically a sundial, but a very special sundial, and gives the date and the time of day where you are once you set it up and you adjust it for your location, etc. It gives the date and the time, and it tells you a lot about what the sun is doing throughout the year. You can also adjust it for the fact that Earth has an elliptical orbit, so you can adjust for your watch time. Your watch time is an average time. It doesn't correspond with sun time or star time. It corresponds a little better with star time, but what your watch does is the mean solar day. So it's really based on sun time, but an average sun time. So it wanders from true, if you look at your watch and it's noon, it's not always where the sun is highest in the sky during the day. That changes. So your watch is kind of an averaged time over the course of a year. And then plus we have the issue of the leap year. So all of these things come into play. It's fairly complicated. But the point is, your watch does not give sun time. It doesn't give star time. It gives an average time so that we can all have the same time. It's kind of an important thing for all kinds of modern communications, so that things happen. So trains work, scheduling of trains and airplanes and work times, things like that. We don't use sun time anymore. Life would be too complicated because everybody would have to adjust constantly for where they are. If you took a trip 100 miles, you'd have to adjust your watch. And so to eliminate all of that, we've gone to an average standard time, and that's been agreed on internationally. So anyway, to answer the one listener's question about recalendarization and using the sun and where you are, locating where you are on Earth after a pole shift, yes, the recalendarization device was meant to do that. But the best thing to do is to get it, use it on a daily basis, watch the progression of the sun, and then if there were ever were a pole shift, now what you're going to do is start replotting where you are, replotting the difference between your timepiece, if you have a watch, replotting the timepiece and your new calendar. So you're going to recalendar. But it really helps if you've been using your calendar. This is what I told kids in last week's show. Get your parents to get you the recalendarization Sunstar clock. And set it up at your house, out on the deck or out in the front window. If you get sun in a certain window of the house, set it up there so you can watch it every day. Set it up in or someplace outside your window. You set it up on a pedestal, something where you can watch it every day. And now you're going to start to see that sun as it wanders through the year. You're going to see the changing shadows, the changing date and time, and how the sun works. And then if there ever were a pole shift, you would be set to recalendar. For people who, it's like any emergency thing. I always say this about the items on my webpage, whether it's water filters or the pre-filters or my books or the recalendar device. These are things you should be using every day. Every day you should use these. And that will, it's not something you put in a box and leave in the closet and say, oops, there's an emergency. Let's get out the calendar device and start using it. No, this is meant to use now. This is not meant to use so only after a pole shift. This is meant to use now. So you understand the moon and the stars. I'm sorry, the moon. The moon is not used. So that you understand the sun and the stars and how they work together, how to project a calendar, how to build the calendar. There's a device on the plate of the recalendar device which allows you to calculate a calendar way out into the future or into the past. You can go back 20, 30 years and build a calendar. You can discover what day you were born on. Was it a Monday or a Tuesday or what day of the week was it? You can figure that out from this calendar device. And you can build your own calendars. So at any rate, okay, but I'll be talking about more of that in the main science topic. Once again, I apologize for the late posting of the archive last week, and I'll try and be better about that in the future. Just a quick update on cancer. I've got a friend who has been struggling with cancer and also the medical community. I hate to use the word, but a comedy of ridiculousness. He's in a hospice, I guess you would call it that, a care center. They're not giving him anything. They're just giving him basically painkillers, but they won't let him have any natural remedies, things that might help him out, things that people have found over the years actually do away with cancer cells. And they won't let him have any of this. They can't do anything. They don't have any remedies, but they sure won't let them have anything else. Oh, you can't have that. We can't allow you to have this. And now, can you imagine how absurd this is? Here's a man who's been who's in a health facility to basically what they say is to make them comfortable while they're slowly their body is slowly being eaten by cancer, and they can't give him anything. They won't give him anything, but they won't let him have any natural remedies. Now, you can see where this is going. What if this person started taking a natural remedy? And I'll mention what they're looking at. It's the apples from the Osage orange tree are said to be very effective to alkaline the body and to reduce cancer and get rid of cancer. So anyway, they won't let them eat apples. Now, is this absurd? Is this beyond absurd? Well, they can't do that, and the doctor won't approve it. So here he is. Some friends have sent basically the Osage orange apples dried, and they won't let him eat apples from the Osage orange tree. Now, can you imagine if this guy started eating these and all of a sudden started getting better and got up and walked out of this place, they'd be out of business because the vast majority of people are in their facility are elderly people dying of cancer. So what would happen to the medical industry? This is the medical question of the week, and this is also the reason why there will never be a cure for cancer and why chemo and radiation are the only game in town, because they don't kill you. If they don't kill you, you might come back and live for a while, but in most cases, the chemo and the radiation kills you, and then they say, oh, well, cancer killed this person. No. By the way, this person is not allowing them to give him radiation or chemo. And so it's kind of a contest between a contest of wits between this person and the medical industry, and they don't like it. They don't like when you don't just run in there, sign the paper, and take their chemo. And what chemo does is it destroys your immune system, the system that should be fighting cancer. What do the natural remedies do? They build up your system so you can fight the cancer. In my opinion, cancer cells are simply normal cells doing what they should be doing. The body, for whatever reason, due to chemicals or pollution or just because of aging, don't communicate very well. And so the cell goes, just like if you have a cut on your hand or on your arm or whatever, if you have a cut, what do the cells do? They start growing. They start growing until they meet up with other good cells, and then they stop growing, and then they form a scar tissue, a tissue that's stronger, binding, much stronger than the other tissue in the skin or in the muscle or whatever's been cut. And then eventually, if you take vitamin E and other types of vitamins and minerals, those scars will diminish quite a bit. They'll actually go away and they'll be replaced by normal cells again. Otherwise, we'd all look like a big scar from all of the falls and scrapes we've had since we were kids. But at any rate, a cancer cell, and this is from my biophysics course when I was getting my master's degree in physics, and this is from a doctor at the Tulane Medical School who was giving my biophysics course that I took in Tulane as I was getting my master's degree. He said the cancer cells are just normal cells that don't understand. They can't communicate with the cells next to them, and that's due to conditions in the body. He said, we know what cancer is. He said, we just don't know how to get these cells to communicate. So at any rate, and why did they stop communicating? Due to pollution, chemicals in food, chemicals that you get in all kinds of solvents and soaps that you put on your body. Over the years, this accumulates, And so you find people that have cancer probably had susceptibility or were around maybe construction sites or women who clean or farmers who have a lot of chemicals around them. Just look at the person's occupation. Did they smoke? Did they drink alcohol? Did they have other habits? Did they eat? Did they drink a lot of coffee, chocolate, white bread, white rice? What all did they eat? All of these factors. Did they eat a lot of red meat? Did they eat a lot of meat that came from processed or chemically driven farms? So at any rate, these are the issues that the main, what I call the causes of cancer. So what's the cure for cancer? Well, stay away from a lot of those foods and chemicals. And the other thing is people could actually prevent cancer if they maintain their immune system better throughout their life. A lot of this is lifestyle driven. So, but as far as an official cure for cancer, there are items out there that appear to actually reduce cancer and drive it away. And what those involve are oils or other types of alkaline foods in many cases, or herbs, etc., that allow the cells to start communicating normally again. But back to my friend in the hospice, they won't let him take anything. And like I say, wouldn't it be an end to their business if all of a sudden people started becoming cured of cancer, or the cancer went into remission, I believe would be a better word, not cured. I don't think anybody ever gets cured of cancer. You just put it into remission. But if the medical industry, in short, would collapse financially if it weren't for treating cancer patients. It's a big cash cow, and so that's why you'll never see a cure for cancer. They're just not going to allow it. They'll keep you. I just saw a musician's thing. They were going to raise money to cure cancer, to find the cure for cancer. Well, you may as well take your money and put it somewhere else or throw it out the window or whatever, because there's not going to be a cure for cancer. since I was a kid, they've been looking for a cure for cancer, and they're still using the same bloodletting chemo radiation treatment that they were using 50 years ago. Okay. On to the next topic. Explosion on Jupiter this week. An amateur astronomer was watching Jupiter, and there was another astronomer who was videotaping Jupiter. And so they have an explosion that lasted a couple seconds on Jupiter. And so, of course, NASA goes, well, gee, it must have been a little asteroid or comet that crashed into Jupiter. And so here we go back to, and this has been observed a number of times also in the past 10 years, there have been other observations of flashes on Jupiter. Let's go back to, I think it was late 1990s, 1997 or something. Schumacher-Levy 9 was a comet, and the thing that was interesting about this comet was that they knew it would crash into Jupiter. So it got a lot of attention, and as it started making its way towards Jupiter, it broke up into 21 pieces. So now we have 21 little comets roaming around out there, all which are destined to crash into Jupiter. So NASA says, you won't even see anything. They're just going to burrow into the upper atmosphere of Jupiter in all the haze and particles in the upper clouds of Jupiter. You're not going to see a thing. And furthermore, they're going to hit on the far side of Jupiter. And so by the time Jupiter turns around and we get a visibility of these little comets hitting Jupiter, you're not going to see anything. So NASA, very arrogantly, did not train any of their instruments on Jupiter. At least that was their public statement. So anyway, the Russians, who I happened to, at the time, had been working with those atmospheric Russians in Novosibirsk, in central Russia, the Russians had every instrument they could find trained on Jupiter. X-ray detectors, everything ultraviolet, every kind of detector, infrared, everything you could imagine was trained on Jupiter. But remember, the 21 pieces of Comet Schumacher-Levy 9 were going to hit the far side of Jupiter, where we did not have direct visibility. So as the 21 pieces of little water comets started coming into the realm of Jupiter, magically, they changed into sulfur dioxide. Now, this would have keyed off anybody, and there was rumbling through the scientific community that McCanny's concept is correct, because what happened? The comets are attracting the tail material. So what are they doing? They're attracting the ionized material in the local environment. When they were out away from Jupiter, that was water, hydrogen, and oxygen. When they got in closer to Jupiter, all of a sudden sulfur dioxide is one of the main chemicals around Jupiter. So as these 21 pieces, like clockwork, moved in and started moving into the realm of Jupiter, they all changed to sulfur dioxide comets. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, then they move in and they start hitting the backside of Jupiter. Well, what the Russians detected were the biggest explosions that they had ever measured in the solar system or any place. And now what was happening? The comet pieces were coming in, discharging the local capacitor, which caused immense explosions at these small pieces, giving off X-rays, ultraviolet light, infrared light. And how did the Russians detect this? They detected it bouncing off the moons of Jupiter, which were beyond Jupiter. So that's how they knew that these immense explosions occurred. They actually detected the X-rays and ultraviolet light and explosive energy as it went out from Jupiter, bounced off some of the Jupiter moons on the far side, and then were detected at Earth. And, of course, they could determine the amount of energy back from the little comet pieces, extrapolating the amount of energy that was received at Earth. And they said these were the biggest explosions ever known to man in the solar system, outside of the sun. And so they said, this is amazing. This is absolute proof that, number one, these are not dirty snowballs, because they changed into sulfur dioxide comets when they got near Jupiter. Then these tremendous explosions had to be caused by immense electrical discharges. And so but in the Western Hemisphere, they were just a little bit bigger dirty snowball than average. And so now, just the other day, I believe it was September 10th, the amateur astronomer discovered a couple second flash on Jupiter. So what does standard science say? Oh, it's just one of those little asteroids. Now let me explain the atmospheric composition of Jupiter. It's cloud tops. It's mainly gas and cloud up at the cloud tops. There's a lot of chemical aerosols. And these aerosols, it's very thin. It'd be like the Earth's upper atmosphere. So if something comes burrowing in, you're not going to see a flash. It's just going to go in. If you're looking at just standard science, it's just going to go in, disappear, and that's going to be the end of it. There's no reason for something to flash, to give you a bright flash at the surface. But what's happening? It's like a lightning bolt coming out of Jupiter, that electrical discharge. Wham! It hits that nucleus, and all of a sudden, vaporized material and the electrical discharge itself all being visible from Earth. That's what's going on here. But standard science is still stuck in this, asteroid hits Jupiter, causes flash. So anyway, it's just the ongoing hiding of data, corrupting of data, trying to keep the old theories alive at all costs. There is a couple things I wanted to talk about health here. There's a bed bug epidemic in the United States, and here's what's going on. Within the last few years, I took a trip on a train, and the people bring their own blankets, and when they come in to the train, they actually spray down the area, and then they put a blanket on the seat, and they kind of maintain, because what's going on? The bed bugs are being transferred in public facilities, and they can't kill off all the bed bugs that are in trains and other public transportation. So anyway, it's becoming a real problem. And, well, the fact is that we have a lot of people in this country that don't know how to keep clean. And that's the, what else can you say? Their houses are infested. Every place they go, they're dropping these. And so they're getting into hotels, into any kind of public facility. And so it's becoming a real epidemic. Apparently, there are some new products on the market that you just sit around in your house and it kills them and debugs your house. But there's another thing. In this one, this particular issue is very strange. And I don't know what national park this was in. I just heard it briefly as I was listening to a television show. But there's a new virus that's being passed around on ticks that live on mice, and this came from a national park where people stayed in public housing at a national park. There have been many deaths so far, and I'll see if I can get more information on this for next week's show. But I thought it's very strange that this new virus came out of a national park. Why all of a sudden would it turn up there and not somewhere else? And it just sounds like one of those fabricated mill boys viruses that's being from the mill labs, military labs, that's being released on the public as a sample. Like, so you and the family go camping at a national park, and some of them end up dead from some new virus that some nutcase has planted there as an experiment, a human experiment. Anyway, I just want to mention that I'm sure you can look up on the internet. Speaking of nutcase things going on, Syria and the Mid East exploding, you can see CIA and Mossad written all over this. That's all I'm going to mention about that. Other than that, there's a lack of real news on the news. I've been looking around on the various standard news sources, CNN and MSNBC and all of the other ones. I don't see any real news out there. It's ridiculous. But at any rate, let's see. Just a quick solar update. This past week, we were a bit in solar turbulence, and that's why we've had somewhat very rapidly changing weather, very small, powerful solar or small, powerful storm systems, high winds in some places. And so this is due to the fact that we have rapidly changing solar conditions. It's not that they're very strong or anything else. It's just that they're very rapidly changing. Okay, so I'm going to go into the lunar calendar, the lunar calendar. My first point is on lunar calendarization, I'm going to go right into the calendar issues once again. And let me clarify once again. Let's just take a look at what a calendar is. A calendar is a counting mechanism. And we use the stars and the sun. Some people use the moon for holiday dates. You could use Saturn. You could be, say, a Saturn worshiper, and you would use Saturn cycles for your calendar. I mean, you could do that. Why not? It's a counting device. Every year and a little bit, we come around and match up with Saturn, or Uranus, or Jupiter, or you could use the moons of Jupiter for your counting cycle. I've always said, for example, we use what we call the ecliptic. This is the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun. If you were an alien from another star system and you came into the solar system, you would not pick Earth's plane of the orbit to use as your standard for the plane of the solar system. You would probably use the plane of Jupiter's orbit because it's the biggest item. It's a small star orbiting a bigger star. So that's what you would use to define your solar system. Okay, so at any rate, let's come back to planet Earth. What are the time pieces associated with planet Earth? Okay, first of all, Earth spins around on a very regular basis. And by the way, this changes very slightly. There are slight wobbles and let's call them instabilities in Earth's rotation. But for the average person, that's not an issue. So let's just say, for example, that Earth rotates around and we pick a particular star in the sky. And when Earth rotates around once and you're looking at that star up in the sky and it's in exactly the same position in the sky, remember that the stars are way, 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 way out there, and they don't change on a short-term basis or on a 100-year basis. The position of the stars are not going to change very much relative to Earth. So they're going to end up in about the same spot. And by the way, my recalendar device has a chart which shows you where the North Pole is, the true celestial North Pole, which is on a precession, 26,000-year precession, how it moves relative to the North Star. It's a way, if you have a little bit better equipment, even amateur telescope equipment, you can tell what year it is by looking at where our celestial North Pole is relative to the North Star. That's on my recalendar device. So at any rate, there are many things that you can measure out there. But basically, on a year-to-year basis, Earth has a very constant rotational rate. We move around the sun in an elliptical orbit. So the first thing I described was Earth rotating relative to the stars. If you took away the sun, Jupiter, all the other planets, you just left Earth out here spinning on its own, you would have nothing but the stars for reference. And so that would be the guide for your day, for your rotational period, or for your clock. Okay, well now that's not the case. We have the sun. We revolve around the sun in an orbit. It's not a perfectly circular orbit. So when we go around the sun, the Earth continues spinning. And as it goes around the sun, let's look at the spot where it comes back to, where it's in exactly the same spot relative to the stars, those distant stars. So when the Earth has gone around one complete cycle around the sun, one complete orbit, and it's in exactly the same spot looking out at the star, the blanket of stars out in the distant background, we call that 1 year. And it turns out that the Earth spins around on its axis 365 and a quarter times per year. And I said I made a mistake earlier. I said 365.466, so that's incorrect. It's sorry about that. It's 365.25 or one quarter revolution per year. And I think if you look for something very exact, it's 365.2466, and that's where the 466 comes in. Is it's almost a quarter day, it's just a little bit less, and that's why every 100 years we have to adjust the calendar once again, because it's not exactly 365 and a quarter days, it's a little, just a hair less. And so every now and then we have to adjust for that. The quarter day, extra day, every 4 years, that adds up to an extra day, and that's why we have leap year. We have every, like 2012 is a leap year, so February had 29 days this year. So at any rate, every 4 years we have an additional day, but every 100 years we don't have leap year, because that makes up for that little teeny piece that we don't have a quarter extra day per year. It's just a little bit less. So you see all of these adjustments that astronomers and time people who keep real close track of time, they maintain these. We also, by the way, compare time to the cesium clock, and there's various other atomic clock standards that vibrate at a certain perfectly exactly the same resonant frequency. And so what we do is we use that as the basis of time, and then compare that to solar time, to Earth time, to rotations, etc. Okay, so let's look at this. We have 365 and a quarter days in a year. That means the Earth spins around on its axis 365 and a quarter times to get back to exactly that spot on looking out at the star system. Okay, now the Moon rotates around Earth every 28 days. Well, that does not quite make up a month. That's a little bit less. So the full moon and the new moon cycles are constantly sliding, so to speak, through the months. Every now and then, we have a month in which there are two full moons, at the beginning of the month and at the end of the month. But the two full moons fall within the same month, and it's a fairly rare event. It's called a blue moon. So we have an expression, once in a blue moon. So that means not very often. Okay, so anyway, when I said last week that we do not use the moon for calendarization, I'm referring to the Julian calendar. The Julian calendar is the one created by Julius Caesar, 43 BC, and that's the one we use today. We use that today in all of our business and transactions and giving dates and on your watch. And it was maintained throughout the Middle Ages for centuries as the timepiece. And by the way, good timepieces were not available up until, probably into the 1600s, people started developing timepieces. And the way they were developed, they weren't developed by governments, they weren't developed by were not developed by national funding or grants. They were developed by private corporations that needed a good timepiece for navigation, because a timepiece allowed you to determine your longitude, the distance east or west of a certain point on Earth. And, of course, if you're a sailor and you're trying to sail across an ocean, having a timepiece that allowed you to calculate exactly where you were was a very important item, because that could mean the difference between crashing your ship on the rocks or not. I'd say that's pretty important. So clocks were developed to... for navigation, ship navigation, and also weather. A lot of the weather reporting that we have from around the world came from the British Navy, because they were constantly taking data, and all of that data eventually came back to England and was compiled and recorded and maintained. So we have a history of, for example, the minimal temperatures that existed through certain epochs during the Middle Ages. But at any rate, coming back to calendars, we have all of these rotating, orbiting devices out in outer space, and so we have to pick some of them to use. The major ones for Earth are the orbit around the Sun, and then the spinning of the Earth, which gives us the number of days. Okay, so let's look at one particular aspect of the rotation of the Earth. Earth is in orbit around the Sun. Okay, before I said, let's take away the sun, the Jupiter, all the other planets, the moon, just leave Earth spinning on its own here. Okay, Earth is like a spinning, just a spinning ball out in the middle of nowhere. As it spins around once to meet up, to match up with the same direction to the stars out there, that's one stellar day. Okay, but now let's look at the Earth moving around the sun. Okay, we're in an orbit. We're moving. Let's pretend it's a circle just for simplicity. As we move around the sun, the Earth is spinning. Now let's look at where the sun, what's happening to Earth as we search for a point where the sun is highest in the sky or south, perfect south. Okay, as the Earth spins around relative to the stars, okay, it spins around one complete time relative to the stars, but now relative to the sun, it has moved in its orbit, so it has to move a little bit farther so that the sun lines up with the same position on Earth. That would be like noon, for example. Okay, the next day, the Earth spins around. Okay, it's got to spin even farther to match up with noon the next day. So you can see that the star day and the sun day don't line up. Every day the Earth sun day is changing by a little bit. And through the course of the year, finally, when you get back to 365 and a quarter days, then you're back to the original starting point. Earth star day and Earth sun day are lined up again. Okay, so what's the end result? We use Sundays as our counting device for calendars. Astronomers use star days. It's a lot easier for them to use star time because they're looking at the stars. They're looking at things relative to Earth, relative to the star background. Then what we do, and this is thanks to the ancient Babylonians, we take and divide up the night sky into 12 divisions. And that 12 magically gives us a 360-degree circle with 15 degrees in each one. So that's kind of convenient. That's what gives us an hour. That's the number of degrees in an hour. So if you go around in 24 hours in 360 degrees in 24 hours, what you're going to get is 15 degrees per hour. Okay, so now we're going to have 24 time zones around Earth so that we can match our times. And they're going to pick out a zone, kind of a slice, kind of an apple slice out of the Earth. And those are going to be the time zones. And now, for example, I believe Hawaii, they move out way out and they kind of cut a piece out of the Pacific Ocean. So that's included closer to the time zones of the United States because it belongs to the United States. So anyway, Hawaii should be in a different time zone than what it really is, but just, I believe for commerce or whatever to keep it closer to the U.S., that there's a little bit of a juxtaposition in what would normally be the time zone. Also for Alaska extends very far out west. But at any rate, that's the way our calendar and timepieces are set up. We have 24 hours in a day, and then you have to pick a spot on Earth that is the reference point, where the zero time on a certain date, that's where zero is. And by the way, let's look at all of these. Let me continue that thought. That's Greenwich, England. That's where we put the zero-point longitude on Earth, and that's an arbitrary point. And so at Greenwich, England, that's been established as the zero-longitude point as the Earth rotates around on its axis. Okay, so let's look at all of these things that are rotating and spinning and orbiting. We have the Earth rotating on its axis. We have it going around the sun. In one complete orbit, we have the moon going around Earth, and we have other activities going on. The Earth actually precesses like a top, like if you spin a top on a table, it precesses. Well, the Earth does that also in the gravity of the sun and the moon, And so it precesses on its axis, and it causes the Earth's celestial pole to shift on a 26,000-year period. It rotates around. And so anyway, that actual period is 25,772 years. And once again, the inclination of Earth is 23.44 degrees from the plane of the Earth's orbit. And here's another little fact, that one star day is equal to 23.935 solar days. All of this information, by the way, is on the pre-calendar, the recalendar sun-star clock. And as I said before, one of the purposes of the clock, of the sun-star clock that's available on my page, is that if in the future, 10,000 years from now, archaeologists come back to study our society after it has blown itself up through Mideast wars and corruption, political corruption, and bankers around the world, they will be able to look at this and determine what our calendars were, something that we don't have the benefit of this from previous civilizations on Earth. They had calendar information, but we have to somehow adjust that to our own calendar. Well, with this recalendar device, they will be able to build our calendar. Even if there's a pole shift, they'll be able to rebuild our calendar. Okay, so let me continue on the idea of calendars here. All of these cycles and spinning and orbiting, etc., what would be the probability that they would all line up and all be factors and multiples of each other? Because they're just things out in outer space spinning and orbiting, etc. Well, the probability would be zero. That would be very, 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 very unusual to have the exact number of Earth days in a year be an integer number, or the moon orbit to line up with the number of spin cycles of the Earth. These are all very different commodities. They all come from different factors. And so what we do is we pick a couple of them. So we pick the solar calendar and then match it somewhat to the star calendar, where they line up once a year. Now, let's look at another factor. When Earth is moving around in its orbit, I already told you that how to find noon on the day of the sun is the highest in the sky, it's due south. But what happens? Earth is in an elliptical orbit, which means it's moving faster at some times and slower at other times. So that spinning of Earth is constant, but what you have to do is, if we're moving faster, you have to spin a little bit more than average to get sun up to the high noon or due south. And so what happens? Sometimes during the year, the solar day is a little bit longer. And then as Earth moves around and is moving slower in its orbit, well, Earth catches up to the sun in the highest point in the sky and due south, it catches up much sooner, a little bit sooner. So there's a graph, which I've included on the pre-calendar device, and that is called the equation of time. What that does is it allows you to transfer or translate between solar time and watch time. There are other factors. If you, for example, your watch gives the mean time in the central part of your time zone. If you're 100 miles west or 100 miles east of the center part of your time zone, then your watch is not going to agree with your sun time. There's all kinds of adjustments that have to be made. So anyway, all of this is described in the instructions that come along with the recalendar sun-star clock. But the best way to deal with understanding all of this is to get the sun-star clock, start using it, and then you'll be able to calculate and do the recalendarization. It's something anybody can do, but it's something that you should have a little bit of experience, see what this sun star clock is doing. And the best way to do that is just to get it, put it up in a place out on your deck where it sees the sun for a good part of the day, or another place where the sun is visible during the day. And then also there's another wheel that comes with it, which is called the star calendar wheel. Take that out at night and match it up with the night stars. And it's a fairly simple device. It's called a star calendar clock wheel. And it's a very simple device. You just match it up with the stars in the night sky, and voila, it gives you the date. So you can work your calendar from either the stars or the sun. Let's see, and the last thing I want to talk about is what happens during a pole shift. Now, I've talked about all of the orbital elements, the rotational elements of Earth, etc. But what happens during a pole shift? Which of these factors changes? Well, the end result is that all of them change. The rotational angle of Earth relative to the sun changes. The rate at which Earth is spinning changes. The orbit of the moon would change. The orbit of Earth around the sun would change. So how do you recalendar? Well, if you have experience in watching these recalendar sun star clock on a daily basis and watching the sun as it moves through its movements throughout the year, and you're watching this and you go, okay, here's the time, here's how I calculate my watch time based on the sun star clock, or you use the sun star clock with stars, either the sun or the stars, you'll start to understand, okay, here's the time, here's the date, with the current setup in the solar system. Here's how I calculate my watch time based on sun time. Okay, that's going to take a little bit of experience. You don't have to know all about the sun and the stars and their motions to do this. You just have to be adept. It's like using a fishing rod and reel. You don't have to know about all the mechanisms in the fishing rod and reel to use it. You just have to go out and practice with it a little bit. So at any rate, I would suggest getting one. Go to the website jmccsci.com, and they're $39.95. If you buy two of them, you get free shipping, or if you buy $200 worth of any combination of products, you get one free. So at any rate, this is Jim McCanny. By the way, I should mention that everything on my website is unique. It's something you're not going to find anyplace else. And that website, jmccsci.com. I'll be back. I'll be talking about a mixture of topics, including more calendar work. It's very complex next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.